UN experts condemn Israel for targeting civilians seeking humanitarian aid in Gaza, saying the regime is intentionally starving Palestinian people. Pro-Palestine rights advocacy groups file lawsuit against the Canadian government for allowing companies to export military equipment and technology to Israel. And the Yemeni army targets two American warships in the Red Sea with missiles and drones in response to acts of aggression by the U.S. and the U.K. Hello everyone, thank you for joining us here on World News. As Israel's genocidal war on Gaza enters its sixth month, more civilians fall victim to regime's ongoing airstrikes on the besieged territory. Now, starting with the north, where an Israeli bombing of the Al-Zaytun neighborhood of Gaza City has left two Palestinians dead and several injured. Cities witnessed also another attack on Palestinians queuing for aid deliveries, leaving several of them seriously injured. In central Gaza, six civilians, including a journalist working for the Al-Aqsa channel, were killed in Israeli bombardment in Deir al-Balah. Number of journalists killed now since the start of Israel's genocidal war stands at 133. To the south, reports say Israel has cut internet access in large areas of Rafah. Now, the total death toll from the Israeli onslaught on Gaza since October 7th has now surpassed 30,600, the majority of them women and children. And our Gaza correspondent, Moti Abu Musabe, joined us earlier on the ground there in the city of Deir al-Balah for an update.
The Israeli airstrikes and attacks continued over the last couple of hours. Let's begin from Khan Yunis city, as the Israeli warplanes targeted and destroyed more residential buildings, particularly in the eastern part of Khan Yunis city and Abasan neighborhood, the neighborhood that was subjected to heavy bombardments and intense Israeli artillery shelling over the last couple of hours. In the meantime, at least 23 Palestinian dead bodies were extracted over the last couple of hours from the same area, left behind the continuous and the chronic Israeli airstrikes and attacks that reached the residential buildings and houses over that area. Here in the central area of Gaza Strip, the Israeli warplanes targeted at least two residential buildings in an Nusayrat refugee camp over the last couple of hours. Dozens of the Palestinian civilians were reportedly injured, and they were brought to the Al-Aqsa Martyrs Hospital here. In addition to that, here in Deir al-Balah city, the Israeli warplanes attacked another group of the Palestinian civilians in the western part of the city. They were also brought to the Al-Aqsa Martyrs Hospital, where in Gaza City, the Israeli artillery maintained its shelling at the southern parts of the city, particularly, and even as the Zaytun neighborhood. It was targeted repeatedly and frequently by the Israeli artillery shelling.
UN rights experts accuse Israel of intentionally starving Palestinians in Gaza. They say regime attacks humanitarian convoys and civilians that are seeking such aid. UN experts said Israel has opened fire on humanitarian aid convoys on several occasions, despite the fact those convoys share their coordinates with the regime. The report also mentions Israel is intercepting deliveries at checkpoints, bombing humanitarian convoys, and shooting at civilians that are seeking assistance. On February 29th, Israel fired on crowds of Palestinians at an aid center in Gaza City, leaving 112 people dead and hundreds injured. The experts called on Tel Aviv to end its campaign of starvation and targeting of civilians. Meanwhile, a senior UN official says the international community must flood Gaza with aid in order to avert further loss of life from starvation in the blockaded territory.
Now, when children starting, as the doctors are telling our colleagues, to die from starvation, that should be an alarm like no other. If not now, when is the time to pull the stops, break the glass, flood Gaza with the aid that it needs? So that is what we need to see happen.
The remarks come as international organizations continue expressing growing concerns over the high levels of malnutrition in Gaza. The WHO says in northern Gaza, 1 in 6 children under the age of 2 are acutely malnourished. UNICEF also warned about extremely high malnutrition rates for children under the age of 5. Meanwhile, the UN Food Agency says it's paused its aid deliveries to the war-torn strip since the 20th of February. The World Food Program said decisions due to continuous return of its food convoys by the Israeli regime from the north, which is literally on the brink of complete famine. Pro-Palestinian advocacy groups in Canada filed a lawsuit against the government for allowing companies to export military equipment and technology to Israel. Lawsuits have been filed by the Canadian Lawyers for International Human Rights Group and the Palestinian Al-Haq Organization and 4 individuals. It says Canadian law bans the military exports to Israel because there is substantial risk they could be used to violate international law and commit crimes against women and children. Since the start of Israel's genocidal campaign, Canada has authorized at least $21 million worth of new permits for military exports to the regime. U.S. and the Netherlands are also facing similar lawsuits over Israel's onslaught on Gaza. Last month, the Dutch court ordered the government to block all exports of F-35 fighter jet parts to Tel Aviv. The Islamic Resistance in Iraq says it's launched a new attack against Israeli targets and occupied territories in support of Gazans. The Iraqi Resistance says it targeted the power station at Israel's Haifa airport using drones, adding operation was carried out in response to the Israeli massacre of Palestinian civilians, including women and children in Gaza. Now, the Islamic Resistance in Iraq has carried out a number of attacks against Israeli targets. Last week, group launched a drone attack on a chemical facility in Haifa as well. Resistance group has also struck major American military bases in Iraq and Syria amid anger over Washington's support for Israel's genocide in Gaza. Meanwhile, the Yemeni army says it's carried out fresh operations against U.S. targets in the Red Sea. In a statement, the Yemeni armed forces say they targeted 2 American warships with drones and missiles. The statement also said attacks were in response to earlier airstrikes by the U.S. and U.K. against Yemen, and also in solidarity with Palestinians. Yemeni forces have targeted over 24 Israeli-linked vessels in the Red Sea since the beginning of Israel's genocidal war. Asana says operations will continue until the regime stops its onslaught and ends its siege on Palestine.
After days of pause in Yemen's naval operations, the spokesman for the Yemeni army announced the successful targeting of an Israeli ship in the Arabian Sea with multiple missiles. He said that the attack followed the drone and missile strikes against U.S. warships in the Red Sea.
The naval forces of the Yemeni armed forces launched an attack on the Israeli ship MSC Sky sailing in the Arabian Sea with a number of appropriate naval missiles. The missiles hit the vessel in an accurate and direct manner. The operation came only hours after Yemen's armed forces targeted a number of enemy American warships in the Red Sea with a number of ballistic missiles and drones.
Experts say this operation sends a message to the US and UK that Yemen's armed forces are still capable of targeting Israeli-bound vessels in the regional waters despite their aggression against Yemen. They believe that the Yemeni army has not used its new weapons yet, which will be another challenge for the Western powers.
Yes, sir, there's operations and the targeting of the Israeli ship and the American warships is a message that the Yemeni armed forces will continue their operations against the enemy. No matter what the Americans do, whether political or military moves, we will continue with our strategic options until the aggression against our brothers in Gaza stops. The Yemeni army will carry out more strikes and still has big surprises for the enemy in the coming days, unless the enemy stops the brutal aggression against Gaza.
On Saturday, the British cargo ship Ruby Mar, which had been targeted by the Yemeni army last month, sank in the Red Sea. The sinking of the Ruby Mar has raised concerns about the potential ecological damage to the Red Sea and its coral reefs, as it was carrying more than 41 tons of fertilizer and had leaked oil for several days after the attack. Yemeni officials hold the US and UK fully responsible for any pollution resulting from the sinking of the British ship. They assert that Washington is the one militarizing the Red Sea, supporting the Israeli war on Gaza and depriving Palestinians of humanitarian aid, which are the main reasons for Yemeni naval operations. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
Now, British politician and lawmaker George Galloway has warned about current state of the United Kingdom, saying country is at a very dangerous time in its history.
I think that we stand at a very dangerous crossroads in our country's affairs, perhaps as dangerous as any since the summer and autumn of 1940-41. And there's no Mr. Churchill in this picture. There's no one, it seems, able to step forward and steady the ship of state and begin to rally, unite our people to face what is a very difficult future. Poverty stalks the land, child poverty in particular.
Galloway made the comments after being sworn in as MP following his by-election victory in Rochdale. He ran a campaign focused on stopping Israel's onslaught on Gaza. The UK's political scene's undergoing profound changes, marked by legal disputes and a significant decline in public support for the ruling Conservative Party. A recent Ipsos poll shows support for the Conservatives, who've been in power for more than 14 years, was at just 20% at the beginning of March. And in the UK, government ministers are considering the expansion of the definition of extremism and banning members of parliament from engaging with protest groups, among them pro-Palestine march organizers. Human rights campaigners, though, say the move is an insult to democracy, as Saeed Puriza reports.
The right to speak out, to protest, the very fabric of democratic rights, once again under attack in the UK, as the government updates its definition of extremism and is about to introduce a potential ban on parliamentarians joining protests. Recommendations from the government's advisor on political violence, John Woodcock, also known as Lord Walney, who is a former chair of Labour Friends of Israel, call on leaders of the mainstream political parties to instruct their MPs to employ a zero-tolerance approach to groups that use disruptive tactics or fail to stop, quote, hate on marches. In the crosshairs, climate activist groups such as Extinction Rebellion and Palestine Solidarity Campaign, who have organized the enormous peaceful mobilizations for Gaza since October last year. Ahead of Walney's recommendations, and after the by-election in Rochdale, Greater Manchester, that handed pro-Palestine campaigner George Galloway a thumping victory, a speech by the Prime Minister vilifying the pro-Palestinian protests demanding a ceasefire in Gaza. Critics say comments like those about peaceful demonstrations are a threat to the long tradition of freedom of protest and expression in the country.
His assertions are totally false. I mean, you know, the claims of an increase in anti-Semitism, of extremism, there is no evidence for that. I mean, this is just pure invention and another indication, frankly, of how weak this government really is. To have a special address to the nation as if there was some sort of state of emergency. Some people that spoke to me thought that we'd declared war on Russia. What it was George Galloway, the leader of the Workers' Party, getting elected as a Member of Parliament. I mean, that should be celebrated, not attacked in that way. It's just absolutely ridiculous.
The new changes are yet to be announced and legislated, but the political temperature is rapidly rising in the UK.
In its 2024 World Report, Human Rights Watch says that the UK government's practices and policies have severely curtailed domestic human rights protections. Others say the country is at risk of turning into a police state masquerading as a democracy. The question now is, how deep will those erosions go? And will the MPs in the building behind me allow them to continue? Saeed Purizep, London.
Iran's Al Alam Arabic News Network once again gets targeted by censorship on Western social media platforms. Social networks such as X, YouTube, and Instagram have taken down all Al Alam accounts. YouTube deleted Network's channel on Google without explanation, contrary to its usual procedure of sending a warning and then giving you the possibility of protesting through email. And this is not the first time all Alam's social media pages have been blocked. Back in 2020, Facebook also removed the channel's verified page with over 7 million followers. Al-Alam has been at the forefront of reporting Israeli crimes against the people of Gaza. Iranians mark a National Tree Planting Day. Every year, just before Iranian New Year, millions of people in the country plant trees to promote greenery development and welcome the beginning of spring. Farzan Ashuriyun reports from Tehran.
Planting trees is one of the important actions in preserving the natural resources, enriching forests, creating forest parks in order to preserve the environment. March 5th marks Arbor Day or National Tree Planting Day in Iran. On this day, which is celebrated to promote the development and preservation of greenery across the country, Iranians plant trees or saplings and encourage others to do so. In December, the Iranian government announced the launch of a project to plant 1 billion trees across the country in 4 years' time. According to officials, the project, which can significantly lead to preserving the environment, is in accordance with international treaties. The goals of the 1 billion tree planting project in Iran include revitalizing natural jungles, increasing urban green space, and countering sandstorms, as the country's climate is mainly arid. Planting these trees can also affect the neighboring countries. More than 30 million seedlings and seeds have been planted in the whole country in the last 3 months. In addition, 116 million seedlings have been produced in the public sector and 121 million seedlings in the private sector. Farzan Ashuriyun, Tehran.
And that's it for your latest, everyone. Thank you for joining us here on World News.
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily, round the clock, for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard by the internet, shortwave, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 31 meters, 9,650 kilohertz every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Southern Africa can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our program via FM 91.5 MHz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on IranSat or BAT 5 and IntelSat 39 and via the internet. Our internet address is pasttoday.ir/en. Now you can listen to Arabi English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about our audio quality and other means. Thank you.
in the limelight.
The Bahrain Grand Prix is 20 years old this weekend, but away from the celebrations on the track, activists tell a dark story of power and repression. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for the second part, please. Middle East Eye wrote, the issue of repression in Bahrain, though, was known to F1 from the start. Speaking to MEE in 2021, Bernie Ecclestone, the man who ran the motorsport for 4 decades and who did the deal to bring it to the island kingdom, told the story of how the Grand Prix came to the Persian Gulf. In 1999, Salman bin Hamad Al Khalifa, Bahrain's new Cambridge-educated crown prince, got in touch with Ecclestone. Ecclestone said, completely behind the idea of staging a race in Bahrain because he realized that it would be the best thing that could happen for the country. As plans for the race progressed, Ecclestone met with opposition figures and local activists. He said, when we first went there, we had a bit of trouble with the local people who were upset about what they thought the rulers were doing. In the end, I met all the protesters and really sat with them and talked to them. I said to them at the time, what you're looking for is a revolution, really. That's what normally happens. And then you attack the crown and capture the country. I said that's the only thing you can ever do. Ecclestone wasn't expecting Bahrain's barricades to be stormed, though. He told MEE, I mentioned that was what would normally happen when these things happen, knowing full well there was no way in the world it could happen because they would never be able to do that. In 2004, the first Grand Prix took place, with Michael Schumacher winning for Ferrari. Ecclestone, who was replaced as chief executive of the Formula One group in 2017, years after he had stock deals to bring the motorsport to Bahrain and the UAE, was clear about what he thought the Persian Gulf rulers wanted to do with F1. He told MEE, this is what you wanted to do, to use the brand to promote the country, which is what they wanted to do, obviously. It suited us and it suited them. You have to pay the price for that. They realized it was cheap anyway for the amount of publicity they got. We all knew exactly what we were doing, and by luck, I think it worked out right. At last year's Bahrain's Grand Prix, 4 protesters were arrested after demonstrating near the track. Former political prisoners Hajar Mansour and Najah Yusuf were among those arrested. Yusuf told Middle East Eye that they were then treated inhumanely by a senior police officer. She had previously served 2 years in prison for protesting F1. 2 men were arrested alongside them, Ali Mohanna and Monir Moshaima, whose brother was executed in 2017. At the time, the Bahraini government issued a statement which was passed on to MEE by an F1 spokesperson saying that no one had been arrested. In the last week, Mansour and Moshaima's family have had their houses raided by Bahrain police. Mohanna received a police summons, but when he turned up at the station, he was told it had been an accident. Yusuf, having had no contact with the authorities since 2023 Grand Prix, received a text message asking her to go to the police station. She did not go. Al-Wadai said, "If you ask me why this has happened to them all in the past week, I would say the message is clear. They want to make sure nothing happens around the Grand Prix." Moussa Satrawi is now 42 years old. He has been in London for almost 2 decades, but continues to campaign for his people, the people of Bahrain. 3 of his brothers are in prison back home. He has not returned to the island kingdom since he left. He is scared sometimes that he will be sent back there. He said, "The Grand Prix helps them. Of the political repression exercised by authorities in Bahrain, it helps them to do this."
IRIB English Radio presents Viewpoints.
Viewpoints.
With the presence of different scholars.
The presence of different scholars. IRIB English Radio.
Assalamu alaikum to dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. This is Viewpoints, and analysis on the thoughts and speeches of the leader of Iran, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei. I'm Atta, the host of this program. With me in the studio are 2 guest speakers from the Islamic House of Qom, Sheikh Sadiq and Brother Ali. Assalamu alaikum to both of you.
Wa alaikum assalam wa
rahmatullah.
Very welcome to the show, Viewpoints. So regarding the speeches of the leader of Iran on the concept of human being, and the we can say the most important speeches that the rahbar gave on the role that the human being might have in today's world, there have been a series of discussions, and we try to get into the different dimensions and angles of the life of the human beings. Now, for today's discussion, we want to talk about a very important topic, with which the today's generation and also today's movement are also very engaged with, and that is freedom. They somehow define it as liberty, but I think freedom is a better term when we are talking about the Islamic one, because liberty might have root in some specific humanism in the Western theology and philosophy, but freedom in Islam might be defined in a different way. But Sheikh Sadiq, what is this monotheistic look? I mean, if we want to explain it for our dear listeners, how the concept of Tawheed and freedom might be connected, how do you define it? How do you explain it?
It's a very good question. I think one of the verses in the Quran that talks about this is overlooked because it's mentioned within a story, the story of Prophet Yusuf.
Mm-hmm.
When the prisoners ask Prophet Yusuf about the meaning of their dreams, Prophet Yusuf first gives them a theology lesson. He asks them this very fundamental question. He asks, أَأَرْبَابُ مُتَفَرِّقُونَ خَيْرٌ أَمِ اللَّهُ الْوَاحِدُ الْقَهَّارُ. Which one is better, having just one God or many gods? And you can see that there is no option for no God.
Okay.
We're always a servant.
Yes.
So the only options are you either have one God or you have many gods.
That's right.
Because we're not gods, right? We're not invincible.
Yes.
We're always in need for different things. We need food. We need security. We need a lot of things to be able to sustain ourselves. So we either have one God who is our sustainer, who is our Razzaq, or we have many gods. We have our boss. We have our wife, our children,
Yes.
Our manager, our principal, the bullies in the school.
The statesman.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay.
Our desires, our anger, yeah. All of these become gods. And each of these want to take us towards itself, right?
Okay.
So we have many gods or just one God. Which one is better? And of course, just having one God, one set of rules, gives you more freedom than having many gods that contradict each other, right?
Yes.
So this is the fundamental basis of freedom when we talk about freedom in the context of Tawheed.
That's right.
Right? And this is why fundamentally you will never be able to get freedom in any other context.
Yes.
Other than Tawheed.
You're making
this is why they're struggling
yes.
in the West
yeah, yeah.
to define the best way to get to freedom, and they will never succeed.
And the more they struggle in such kind of freedom, their thirst will now be quenched, because
yes.
every day they are looking for a new type of freedom.
Yes.
Because this way, as you said, you know, has made them very much busy around themselves. They are engaged with different things. So here is this style, and year after year, they cannot find that kind of freedom. That's why you see the rate of committing suicide in the West is really high, yeah. you know. And whenever they say, we do not find that kind of freedom satisfaction inside, that's why we want to be free at last, okay, by killing ourselves. That's a kind of, you know, this is also a wrong definition. So one God and many gods. So for sure one God will make you more free than many gods. That's right, because you are not more busy than that one. So what other things do we have in a monotheistic look?
Basically, that's the root of it.
Okay.
Right? You have one God and you have one set of rules, one thing to be concerned about. The hadith that we have, اجعل همك هما واحدا. You have only one thing to think about. Like when you get up, you go to work for Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala.
Mm-hmm.
When you're with your family,
that's right.
You're not trying to satisfy them based on their will.
Okay.
You're only thinking mm-hmm. about the will of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala.
That's right.
And this gives you freedom, internal and external.
Okay. But this does not mean, Brother Ali, that we must forget the world around, is it?
Very true.
I mean, because some people will sacrifice everything for the sake of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. To become the absolute servant of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala does not mean necessarily to leave the world around yourself.
Mm-hmm.
It means that have your life, but your intention, your niyyah must be towards the monotheistic look, Allah subhanahu, but not the material self. Is it so?
Okay. Actually, the kind of way that you're presenting a question actually brings a sort of, let's say, misconception in the answer. But let me clarify. Submission to God and sacrificing everything of yourself towards God actually is something that you give freedom to others as well. So it's not that, for example, you leave the freedom of others or the freedom of yourself. On the other hand, if you sacrifice whatever you have for the sake of God, it does not mean that you have left the world, because Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, He Himself wants you to benefit from the world and enjoy the world that you are living in. So it does not mean to recommend you to select a life of isolation. So when Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala asks you to step in this way and you sacrifice whatever you have for the sake of God, it means that you have accepted all the conditions and all the circumstances of this submission, which is actually giving the right to both sides of a human entity, that is a worldly and material aspect and also the spiritual aspect of it. So it means that when we are sacrificing and we are devoting ourselves toward God, it means that we are actually paying attention to both sides, not only one side of it. So it doesn't have anything to do with isolation or living in isolation or secularism. One more point I want to add to whatever the respected Sheikh said, to actually as a compliment on his beautiful explanation, is that in a Tawhidi or monotheistic freedom, actually there are not only external factors but also internal factors internal factors are even more important than external. In a humanistic worldview, actually, freedom is being affected only by external factors, like what, till the time that others restrict your freedom or you restrict the freedom of others. But what brings this sort of confrontations? It is rooted in something internal. Our selfishness, the things that we like and hate, the things that actually this likeness and hatred actually should have a taste of God when it is when it has something rooted inside the self, so it cannot be a good criteria. Then it causes the external factors. Then this is the time that actually your freedom or the freedom of others is being violated by you. So in Islam, actually, both aspects of internal and external factors are looked at. But in a humanistic worldview, only the external factors are looked at. And they, since they do not actually believe in the source of these factors, which are internal ones, they never look at these factors.
That's right. At the same time, the case is that somehow we are opposing the Western world with Islam, but still I think in the Western philosophy and the Western world, we can find some thoughts which are oriented towards divinity, okay? This is not the absolute Western world and the whole West, the Western world, world's look, you know, at the world and the type of freedom is like this, because, you know, we can find so many monotheistic.
Look, it does not mean that we are not saying,
I mean,
that
outside the world of Islam, there are so many freedom seekers.
No, brother, no. And we are not saying that whoever lives in the West actually does not believe in the divinity of God, or let's say the uniqueness of God.
Okay.
You can be a believer in the uniqueness of God and a Tawhidi, actually, worshipper, but at the same time, you believe in the definition of liberty or freedom in that sense.
Okay.
So we, in case we have accepted God, we need to actually believe in its actually consequences itself, as well. I want to correct this actually wrong presumption.
Yes.
Whoever lives, or whoever, even among the Jews and Christians,
yes,
it does not mean that they necessarily do not believe in God. They might believe in God, and they do believe in God, actually. But the kind of definition that they are making from freedom is different.
Okay. And Sheikh Sadiq, don't you think that this type of freedom, I mean, in terms of the divinity and the monotheistic one, this might be a question for some listeners, that will bring you a kind of limited life, at the same time, backwardness from the world around? Because based on the liberty and liberal, we can say, how can I say, philosophy, the world has made its progress and developments, especially in the 20th century and the 21st century. We know that after the Enlightenment period and the industrial movements, okay, all this progress that have been made was based upon this type of freedom. So don't you think that the monotheistic one will make you stop from being develop or progress in your life?
In some interpretations of religion, that could be the case, and that is the case. Like, if you look at Amish people in the United States, some of them, they don't have electricity, they don't use cars, they live in villages, because all of these are evil to them.
Okay.
And Christianity is notorious for this. And I think the point that dear brother was trying to make was that Christianity creates this very strict line between the kingdom of heaven and the kingdom of earth. And the kingdom of earth, we don't have anything to do with it. Religious people, it's just for tyrants and oppressors. And the kingdom of heaven is for God. But in Islam, لِلَّهِ مُلْكُ السَّمَوَاتِ وَالْأَرْضِ, there is no distinction. Heavens and earth, it's all for Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. We live on earth according to Allah's rule, and we get to heaven through our life on earth. You could say that we have some problems even in Shia interpretation of religion because of the fact that we don't have our imam. Like, just imagine we've received the last update like 1400 years ago.
Okay.
Right? Yes. And we're trying to make that work, and our ulama have done their best, but until you have your imam, the hujjah of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, who knows the core, knows what religion is truly about, he can tell you that, okay, there's no problem, you can do this, you can do that, you can have these rules that work for the modern world and work for your malakut as well. But because we don't have access to malakut, we're just trying to figure out what the core is and trying to somehow work with the modern world. So the problem is there to some extent, but even with that, looking at different religions and comparing them, I think we have the most progressive way of looking at religion and how to apply it to the modern world.
That's all right. Thank you very much, Sheikh Sadiq. And Brother Ali, thank you very much for your presence in the program. Viewpoint, it was very kind of you, the concept of freedom and liberty as discussed by the leader of the Islamic Ummah, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei. It was very kind of you. And dear listeners, thank you very much for listening to us. This is Viewpoints. I'm Atta, the host of this program. For more information, visit our website at parstoday.com/Ian Call of Islam page. Also, you can visit our YouTube channel and Instagram page, Call of Islam Radio. To another episode, God bless you all. Fi amanallah.
The same when I'm too concerned by what they say. Why should I when I have you? To doubt you would be the worst mistake. Deep inside I know that amidst all the darkness and everything which makes no sense, I know that you exist. Guides me through my darkest nights, shows me right from wrong in life, a world that often lies. Cause I don't need anyone, anything in life, but you. No, I don't need anyone to show me my way. No, I don't need anyone but you.
Follow us on social media to stay up to date on the latest global developments. You can keep in touch with us by following us on Twitter at twitter.com/ParsTodayEN. You can also follow IRIB English Radio on Instagram via instagram.com/ParsTodayEnglish.
The limelight.
It is unrealistic to observe the genocidal Zionist regime war on Gaza without understanding its strategic dimension, in particular the current phase of the Palestinian struggle for freedom from occupation. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. Press TV wrote, "The daily war crimes committed by the Israeli regime's military in Gaza make it easy for the global audience to watch with horror the brutality of the occupying regime and the suffering of Palestinians. The Israeli regime has a long history of massacring Palestinians and Arabs, but now, with the advent of social media, the world is waking up to the harsh reality of this child-killing machine. It is essential to return to the Operation Al-Aqsa Storm on October 7, 2023. The facts on the ground remain that the victory of the Palestinian resistance in the world's largest concentration camp will go down in history above everything else in the ongoing Israeli genocidal war on the Gaza Strip." Everything related to this historic victory in the besieged territory last October is linked to regional developments after the resistance movement Hamas dramatically shook the Israeli regime's intelligence and security apparatus. The Palestinian resistance is not fighting at the moment because it has a mission. The mission was to some extent achieved on October 7th. Right now, it is fighting to defend Palestinian civilians. These broad daylight Israeli regime massacres and war crimes are indeed barbaric and join the long and dark history books of the Israeli occupation. Yet, the historic Palestinian victory will always be the defining goal in any negotiations and the operation that changed the military equation between the Gaza resistance and the Zionist regime army should not distract observers from the mission of the resistance. October 7, 2023 accomplished this mission to a large extent. It was a mission that destroyed the Israeli regime's army's self-proclaimed military superiority over the Palestinian resistance. All efforts by the regime's military and intelligence officials to reverse this equation and resume normal services to their American masters have failed to materialize. The mission that restored Palestine on the map has also seen the Palestinian struggle back in its rightful place alongside all the rights of Palestinians that had long been ignored by the international community despite being enshrined in international law. Al-Aqsa Storm is what achieved this. After decades of silence, the state of Palestine sits at the top of the agenda, where it belongs. Governments across the globe, along with meetings between world leaders rushing back and forth to West Asia and beyond, are discussing Palestine with the seriousness it deserves. A Palestinian state with currently occupied Al-Quds as its capital is back on the table among top officials who had forgotten that there was a Palestinian state in the first place. All Israeli, American, and British military attempts to return West Asia to how it was before Operation Al-Aqsa Storm have proven futile. They have not and will not succeed, not in this lifetime. If Americans seek to go to war on behalf of its proxy illegitimate entity in West Asia, it would effectively end the Israeli occupation of Palestinian land. The Zionist regime has been defeated, its global image has been disgraced, its economy is in shatters, and its army in Gaza is enduring what the US faced in Afghanistan, a disgraceful drubbing. Militarily, the Israeli regime army is all over the place against the resistance in Gaza. To advance in urban warfare, Israeli special forces need their backup units to secure and hold on to the areas that the elite forces had captured so the latter can advance to the next area. After more than 4 months of unbridled aggression, the Zionist regime military has not achieved this simple military strategy in one single spot in the entire Gaza Strip. Its special forces cannot hold onto an area, not to talk about backup units that are in total disarray. A month ago, the regime regularly announced that it had taken control of northern Gaza. Today, Hamas is still fighting in northern Gaza neighborhoods as well as central and southern Gaza. Where does this leave America, the country that promised protection to the Israeli regime on October 7th, the country that has been supplying arms to Tel Aviv regime worth billions of dollars? In the aftermath of Operation Al-Aqsa Storm, the U.S. regime sent its aircraft carriers and military assets to West Asia, instructing Tel Aviv regime to focus on Gaza. Never in the history of the Zionist occupation and all the wars it has waged has the U.S. provided so much support to the regime in Tel Aviv. It has supplied more than $260 billion to Israel since the Second World War, but the kind of support it has given to Benjamin Netanyahu regime since October 7th is unprecedented. Militarily, diplomatically, politically, as well as in the media, and so much more because the regime has been defeated. The recent reports of tension and disagreements between the Zionists and American or British leaders is part of the Western media psychological war to distract viewers from the reality, which is that Tel Aviv and Washington are literally tied to the hip. Washington and London are publicly calling on Tel Aviv to think carefully before expanding its genocidal campaign to Rafah. This is while Capitol Hill is racing against time to ship more bombs to the Zionist regime's military that will arrive in Tel Aviv just in time to drop on the civilians in Rafah. Nevertheless, the last thing America wants is a war of attrition with the axis of resistance in West Asia. Yet the Israeli regime military has proven incapable of achieving anything in Gaza. It can't compete with the Palestinian resistance and is targeting women and children of Gaza in a bid to pressure Hamas. That has opened up three notable West Asian fronts: anti-Israeli resistance movements in Lebanon, Yemen, and Iraq. Some commentators in the region have tried their best to downplay the resistance of Hezbollah in Lebanon and Ansarullah in Yemen against the Israeli regime. It hasn't gone down well for these pundits. Hezbollah has been displaced tens of thousands of Israeli settlers in the northern occupied territories by the regime's own admission and carried out more than 1,000 military operations since October 7th. Some estimates have put the figure of displaced settlers at over 250,000. This is Hezbollah's contribution to the axis of resistance. Never in the history of the Zionist regime has settlers been displaced. Against the backdrop of the mediators that traveled to Beirut calling on Hezbollah to end its operations, the Lebanese resistance sent a clear message: its resistance operations will cease when the Israeli slaughter campaign in Gaza ceases. Ansarullah-led government in Yemen has imposed an embargo in the Red Sea on Israeli vessels transiting or docking in the occupied Palestinian ports. All the American and British warships deployed to the waters and all US-UK attacks on Yemen have failed to deter the Yemeni military or end its embargo on Israeli regime maritime navigation. Furthermore, all of Washington's indirect messages sent to Yemen to end the Israeli regime naval blockade and all the White House incentives to have Sana'a Airport and Hodeidah Seaport fully functional and the payments of all Yemeni civil servants and promises to avoid Jihadin Ansarullah to the U.S. list of terrorist organizations have failed to force change in the Arab country's strategy. The Yemeni resistance, operating from the poorest country in West Asia region, has responded in line with its courageous national ancient history by rejecting all American offers. Yemen says the war started in Gaza and will end in Gaza. Until then, no Israeli ships will be docking in the regime's ports, and all US-UK attacks have only expanded the range of Yemeni fire to Israeli-American British vessels and warships. Yemeni resistance leader Abdul Malik al-Houthi hailed a major victory for the resistance movement in a speech recently, saying the US and UK failed to secure the passage of any ships heading to Israeli-occupied ports over the last week. They were unable to protect these ships. They have no longer protect even American British ships, and this is a real and major victory for us, he asserted. U.S. bases in Iraq and Syria have been subject to some 200 attacks by the Islamic resistance in Iraq since October 7th, again in solidarity with Gaza. American attacks on Iraqi soil have not only failed to deter the will of the resistance, but increased their determination to end the U.S. operation. Again, some analysts on primetime TV shows can't help but make viewers cringe by dramatizing a US bomber that flew so much distance from the United States to Iraq and attacked vital military infrastructure belonging to Hashd al-Sha'bi on the Syrian border in true Hollywood style. And so what? What's the difference if a US warplane took off from an aircraft carrier in the region, and what is vital military infrastructure? Within minutes, the Iraqi resistance fired missiles attacking US bases, again inflicting heavy damage. The United States says it does not seek a wider war in the region, but as things stand, the Biden administration is blindly heading to a war of attrition in the region in a bid to please an Israeli regime premier, who is knowingly escalating regional tensions to escape a court trial and a possible prison sentence.
Iranian news. Iranian culture. Iranian voice. This is IRIB English Radio. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.